To discuss the resumption of hostilities in Nagorno-Karabakh, I'm joined by Anna Walker, who heads our Europe desk. Fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh has made the headlines again. Can you start off with a summary of what's happening?
Yes, so the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh, this is one of really the most serious and deadly frozen conflicts that emerged from the collapse of the Soviet Union. It is also one of the situations that has the greatest potential for conflict to erupt again. And I think the recent fighting that we saw over the weekend of the 2nd of April is really testament to this. Now, there have been frequent violations of the ceasefire between Armenia and Azerbaijan in the past 22 years or so. Roughly several thousand people have been killed since the ceasefire was first declared. This has been mainly soldiers from either side, but also increasingly we have seen the death of civilians living close to the line of contact that separates the armed forces. Now, the clashes that erupted on the 2nd of April were the most deadly since the ceasefire was actually declared in 1994. We have varying estimates of the number of those killed, ranging from dozens of people to several hundred. It's very difficult to get an accurate picture of how many have been killed because there are no independent observers who are sort of situated in that area. Obviously, observers visit quite regularly to try and establish a clearer picture, but we don't have anybody on the ground who can verify those figures. The violations typically occur at politically significant times. So, for example, the recent one actually coincided with the anniversary of the declaration of the ceasefire in 1994. It also coincided with the nuclear security summit in the US, which was attended by both the president of Armenia and of Azerbaijan. And we often see an escalation in the violence around events like this. It's seen as an opportunity, I think, to attract international media attention and focus international political attention on the conflict and on the fact that it's not yet been resolved. Now, there is a peace process underway. There has been for several decades, but efforts so far to reach a settlement have been in vain. The peace talks are held mainly under the auspices of the Minsk Group, which has a mandate from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And it's led by three co-chairs who host the talks. They are from Russia, France, and the US. But the results of these peace talk efforts have been very mixed. The results tend to ebb and flow depending on the political circumstances in each country. We did have a period in the mid-2000s when it seemed as if both sides were close to reaching an agreement on a peace framework. And this was known as the Madrid Principles. There were very positive steps, I think, towards really coming to some agreement on all the key issues. Now, some of these key provisions of the framework, of the peace framework, included the withdrawal of ethnic Armenian forces from the territories surrounding Nagorno-Karabakh, the deployment of international peacekeepers, the creation of a land corridor connecting Nagorno-Karabakh with Armenia, and a referendum on the status of Nagorno-Karabakh. Both Azerbaijan and Armenia were reportedly very close to agreeing on these points, but as ever with these situations, the devil was in the details, and there were some fundamental sticking points that meant that the whole peace process lost momentum. And I think it's safe to say it hasn't really regained that since. Now, of course, these violations of the ceasefire don't really help to advance the peace process. Instead, they serve to highlight how increasingly militarized the situation along the front line has become.
Anna, given that backdrop, what makes the situation different this time? And what are your thoughts about future trajectories? Is the conflict likely to resume? Is it likely to escalate? Where do you see this heading?
Well, although the situation in and around Nagorno-Karabakh is actually one of the most volatile in the CIS region, perhaps leaving eastern Ukraine aside, we still think it's unlikely that we're going to see a resumption of a full-scale conflict. And that's mainly because there is significant international pressure on both leaders in Armenia and Azerbaijan to refrain from escalating this further. The pressure has so far been successful in containing the violence. As we've seen over the past few weeks, a ceasefire agreed on the 5th of April has largely held. But the situation on the ground is gradually evolving, and there are several factors that I think heighten the risk of an escalation in the future. The first is that we are concerned about the increasing use of heavy weaponry, particularly along the front line, and the use of tanks, helicopters, other heavy military equipment. And that's one of the factors behind the increase in the number of casualties, particularly in the latest violations. Now, this partly reflects Azerbaijan's huge spending on defence, in particular purchases of military equipment. And this has really, over the past decade, has altered the military balance in the region. Armenia always had the advantage over Azerbaijan in this respect and was considered to have much the stronger armed forces. But this is probably no longer likely to be the case. For several years now, Azerbaijan has actually spent more on its armed forces and its defence sector than Armenia's entire budget. So that has really shifted the balance toward in favour of Azerbaijan with respect to the availability of weaponry. There's also a different external environment now. The poor state of relations between Russia and Turkey has really added a geopolitical dimension to the conflict that wasn't really there before. Russia has long been seen as the traditional ally of Armenia, while Turkey is Azerbaijan's main external backer. I should add that even here, there's another factor complicating this, in that Russia is also a significant provider of military equipment to Azerbaijan, and as well as that, is one of the co-chairs in the Minsk peace process. So it's safe to say that Russia's role and allegiances in this conflict are somewhat ambiguous. There's also concern that a growing share of the populations in Azerbaijan and Armenia have no memory of living in peace, at peace with each other. Prior to the conflict, which erupted in 1988, there were relatively significant populations of ethnic Azerbaijanis living in Armenia and vice versa. But this is no longer the case. And the generation born since the late 1980s have only known a situation where the two sides are at war with each other. And this means that any civil society efforts to establish bilateral initiatives that might advance the peace process face a real uphill struggle to win acceptance. Another factor is that the economic situation in Azerbaijan has significantly changed over the past couple of years. There's a real risk that escalating the conflict might be seen as a diversion from the deteriorating economy, an opportunity to distract public attention from what's likely to be a very difficult economic year. The IMF is now predicting that the economy in Azerbaijan will actually decline by 3% in 2016. And when you consider that growth reached an average of about 30% in the mid-2000s, this is a very sharp deterioration. So we do have some concern that the authorities might see the conflict as bringing short-term gains in terms of public acceptance, public popularity. But actually, in the longer term, this would really seriously dent efforts to attract investors to the region and to diversify the economy.
Anna, the region has a fairly significant role to play in Europe's efforts to diversify its sources of energy. The region is also a fairly important transit link. What role does the conflict play in changing that equation, and what are the broader implications for the wider Caspian region?
One of the factors that actually acts as a constraint, particularly on Azerbaijan, with respect to the conflict, is that it is so heavily dependent on oil and gas exports and really sees its future in connecting the region, the Caspian region, to Europe. As you say, it's not only a producer of oil and gas, but actually becoming a very significant transit route for oil and gas from the Caspian region to the rest of Europe. So it's certainly not in its interest to escalate the situation. And any short-term gain from retaking territory, for example, would actually probably carry significant costs through the disruption to oil and gas export routes in the short term, and then in the longer term through the serious dent that this would give to investor confidence. I think it would really make prospective investors think twice about committing to Azerbaijan if they felt that the conflict was likely to re-escalate. I think equally it gives the fact that Azerbaijan is such a significant energy producer and transit route gives the EU and other Western countries a stake in actually pushing for peace in the region and trying to guarantee this peace. Azerbaijan is due to supply about 10 billion cubic meters of gas to Europe in the coming years. Obviously, this is a relatively small share when you think of the EU's overall gas imports. But nevertheless, Azerbaijan is seen very much as an important component of the EU's Southern Corridor, which is intended to strengthen links between the Caspian region and Europe with the aim of diversifying gas imports away from traditional suppliers such as Russia. The viability of these projects would come under really serious threat if the conflict were to resume. Certainly with a very significant long-term impact on Azerbaijan, but potentially also on all those European companies and European investors that see the region as an important new destination for their investment and as a source for new energy.
Anna Walker, thank you very much.